Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
I've never felt like this before. It's like you just get me. I feel like my true self with you. Does that sound crazy? And it doesn't hurt that you're gorgeous. Okay, that's it. I'm taking you home with me. I mean, you can't find shoes this good just anywhere. Find a shoe for every you from brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, and more at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Barry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Barry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with someone you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One-on-One, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
I was never a coach that like wanted to play mind games with kids, right? I wanted to tell them, hey, this is what we think. This is what we need you to do better. This is what you need to do to play. Whether you were the best guy on the team or the last guy, try to tell kids the truth. Sometimes they didn't want to hear the truth, but, you know, tell them the truth and treat them fairly. And if you did that, then things would go well.
And our guest this week, Brian Volker. He just retired after 15 years as the head men's lacrosse coach at Drexel University. Has an incredible resume and career in the game as a player and a coach. And Brian, thanks so much for coming in studio.
You got it. Thanks for having me.
So the decision to retire, was this something that had been, I don't know, in the works, but in your head you had kind of been plotting out what it would look like? Or was it you kind of, at the end of a season, you kind of took stock and said, I don't know, where did it come from?
To be honest with you, I thought about it a little bit a year ago. My son was a senior at Georgetown, and if he would have played a little bit more on the lacrosse team, I probably might have thought about doing it a year earlier to go see him play. But we also had to pay those Georgetown tuition bills, so that was part of it. I sat down with my wife after the season, and we just felt like it was time. I'd been a head coach for 20-plus years, 7 years at Penn and 15 at Drexel, and just had a great experience and loved doing it, but felt like it was time to move on and do something different.
How long did it take for it to feel real, or does it still not quite feel real because you're not to the season part yet? Obviously, you would be doing work, but where are you mentally as far as with the decision?
Yeah, it feels real, but, I haven't really had a chance to miss it yet. And obviously, Drexel's going through their fall practices right now. I think they actually end up maybe even this week, the end of this week or the end of next week. And you definitely miss the day-to-day with the guys on the team and the coaches and, other people in the athletic department. But it also is great to have free time and be able to go down to the shore and take a deep breath and do some traveling and spend some time at home. And the good news is my wife doesn't have too many honey-do lists for me. So as soon as that starts happening, maybe I'll regret stuff. But it's been great so far.
And what do you think it'll be like, February, March, when you would be waist-deep into the season? Do you think that's going to be weird, or do you think you have enough time to kind of get used to this new lifestyle where it won't hit you like it might?
I think it'll be weird. It'll definitely be weird watching games and seeing scores. And, I'll be following the Drexel team very closely and seeing how they're doing, and that'll definitely be different. And I think that's when it really will hit you, when the games start playing. But, I made the decision. I feel really good about it. And, my wife, my family is excited about it. So, and I'll be in Florida for the month of February, so I'll be warm and not at Vitus Field freezing.
What was your favorite part about being a coach in general?
during your years doing it?
Yeah, I mean, I did some other things before. Right when I got out of college, I coached for a year at Princeton University, and then I got out of coaching for a little while before I got back in as an assistant at Johns Hopkins. So I really got to appreciate a lot of the day-to-day stuff and being with the kids. I think the relationships, obviously the competing, the wins and the losses, and, you know, just being with kids on a daily basis, being with your coaches, trying to figure out, you know, game plans and recruiting plans and some of that stuff. I mean, all that stuff is great. Like any job, there's stuff that drives you crazy. But yeah, you know, game days is the best. And you know, I loved playing, and you know, I had great experiences with a lot of my coaches, and they meant a lot to me. So I hoped I mean the same thing to the kids that I coached, you know, the last 20 some years.
As someone who has been at high level lacrosse for about four decades, going back to playing, you know, college and stuff, how has the sport change, and I don't mean the actual game, I mean how it is covered, how it has injected itself into the mainstream, where, you know, I don't think when you were playing, lacrosse was a headline sport on ESPN like it is now. And how have you seen it change, and what has it been like to see the sport grow exponentially over your career?
You know, when I was in high school, it was really a regional sport, and the region was Baltimore, Long Island, and upstate New York. Even Philly in those days was just starting to kind of come onto the scene, and now Philly's one of the best areas, you know, in the country. But, you know, lacrosse has kind of grown in these pockets. You know, now there's pockets, you know, down in Florida, there's pockets in Atlanta, there's pockets in Texas, there's pockets in California, all over the Midwest and you know, like the Pacific Northwest. There's great pockets in Canada. So I just think you see that. So back when I played, when you looked at teams like Drexel, they weren't even really, you know, something you would ever think about as being at a really, you know, a level that could, like, compete with a Johns Hopkins and all that stuff. And now the great news for the sport is it's grown so much at the youth and the high school level. It hasn't really grown so much at the Division I level that you squeeze all those kids from all these new areas and you get a place like Drexel that now can compete, you know, that can win an NCAA tournament game, that can you know, a couple of years ago, give Notre Dame a run, you know, all those things. And back in my day in high school, that never happened. You know, in my day, if you didn't play high school in Baltimore or Long Island or some areas in New York, then you probably weren't going to go play Division I. There are very special cases. Now you look at the rosters and it's, you know, it's like the Mid-Atlantic is the big chunk of just about every roster, you know, kind of East Coast roster. But then there's kids from really all over. There's, you know, 20, 25, 30%, 40% of kids from, you know, all over the country and Canada.
What do you think has fueled this growth? Is it just the strength of the sport itself, that it just translates well, that once people get exposed to it, they fall in love with it? Do you think it is the way it's been covered TV-wise? Is it the strength of the college program? Like, why do you think we have seen this explosion over the last 20, 30 years in the sport?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question. And I think if, you know, if probably even if lacrosse people knew the answer to that, that would even be expanding more. You know, the excitement with the Olympics coming up, with lacrosse being added to that, they think it's going to help. But I think it's all of it. I think it's the coverage. I think it is a really cool sport. I know personally, I played baseball and lacrosse growing up. I wasn't very good at baseball. I couldn't hit. You know, I feel like that's, I don't want to say it's more of a skill than an athletic thing, but it's a very unique, you know, thing to be able to hit a baseball or pitch a baseball, right? I think with lacrosse, there's a little bit more athleticism, and there, you know, not that there's not skills involved in it, but I think people think the game's cool. You know, seeing the big crowds on Memorial Day on those weekends, seeing games a lot on, you know, on ESPN and now on, you know, some of these other cable channels, kids being able to plop on the internet now and watch all these games that the colleges, you know, stream. You know, all that stuff is great for the sport, and hopefully it just continues to grow.
So you mentioned playing baseball and lacrosse growing up. What was your introduction to lacrosse? Like, how did it come into your life?
Well, I grew up in Baltimore, and obviously lacrosse is a pretty big deal down there. But I grew up in a kind of a town in you know, just outside of the city, that lacrosse wasn't a huge thing. My uncle played lacrosse at Loyola, and that's kind of really, you know, there were some of these old, like, wooden sticks around the house, and I didn't, you know, kind of really know what they were. And, you know, just kind of growing up around there, started, like, messing around with them a little bit and just decided to go out and play rec and when I was, you know, 9 years old. And but I you know, till I was 12, 13 years old, I played, you know, all kind, I did everything. I played, you know, football, basketball, baseball, lacrosse. I mean, just kind of played a lot of sports. Sports were big in my house.
When did lacrosse start to rise to the top of the list?
I think, you know, lacrosse and football started to get there right at the beginning of high school. I was really small in high school. I was also probably a year younger than most, you know, where I went to high school, most of the guys in the grade below me are as old as I am or older than me. These days, that doesn't happen. Kids stay back 3, 4, 5 years. So the football thing started to get, you know, playing at a higher level and being a 150-pound linebacker my senior year. I don't think any of the big boys were really going to come after me. And the great thing with lacrosse is you look out there, there's, you know, guys all shape, sizes, and I think that really kind of separated stuff.
When did you start to realize you were good?
I mean, I guess when I was little, I always thought I was good at stuff. But I was a good athlete. You know, I love sports. I grew up with my grandparents. My grandfather was way into sports. You know, we would go and shoot baskets and play catch with footballs and baseballs. He wasn't a lacrosse guy. He was from Perth Amboy, New Jersey, so lacrosse wasn't his thing. But, you know, I played a lot of sports. We all were always playing pickup football and basketball and just running around and doing, you know, sports stuff, and I was always pretty good at it. And I liked it a lot, and I love lacrosse, and I used to go to a lot of, like coaches used to have their like clinics and stuff that I used to go to. And I just realized that I could kind of play with anybody, and I just liked it a lot. So
what was it about the sport that resonated with you? The sport itself?
You know, I liked running into people a little bit. I liked the physicality of it. As soon as I started playing, I played defense. My high school coach for a couple of games experimented me with playing some offensive midfield, probably because we needed the help as much as anything. But I just never considered really being an offensive guy in lacrosse. I always loved being a defenseman and just kind of love kind of whacking guys in the arms and going up and picking up ground balls and stopping guys. So I just liked it a lot. Just clicked with me.
When did you start to think that lacrosse was going to be able to carry you further than most?
It helped me get into a really great high school in Baltimore. Gilman is where I went to high school, and it's a great school down there. And there was a lacrosse connection, so that's why I went there. And then obviously getting into Johns Hopkins, which I probably wouldn't have been able to do without lacrosse. I think those two things really started it. And then, you know, when you go to Johns Hopkins, and lacrosse is such a big deal down there, and I was not the most serious student, and I concentrated a lot on being a really good athlete and a really good lacrosse player. And, you know, when I got out, I had the opportunity to then be a coach, and that kind of started the path. When I got out of coaching, you know, I had two different jobs, and both of them were good, and I liked the people that I worked with and all that stuff, but I just always kind of had that itch, and I still played a lot. Obviously, I was playing on the wings back then, and there was, you know, club ball back then going on, and was still playing a lot of lacrosse and still staying in shape and lifting and running and stuff. And then when Coach Seaman, you know, gave me the opportunity to come back to Johns Hopkins and be an assistant coach, I quickly talked to my wife and snapped it back, that opportunity up.
When you first start playing at Hopkins, what is the transition like? Because you are going into one of the and as we mentioned, there's dozens of them now, but this was one of the 3-4 real bastions of college lacrosse.
They had just won the national championship the year before.
So walking into that, was it, oh my goodness, or were you comfortable like, all right, you know, it's a little better, a little faster, but I'm fine?
Well, I think the good news is there was a summer league down in Baltimore that when I was in high school you played, and it wasn't high school kids. I actually played up and played with a lot of the club guys and the older guys and the college guys. So I knew I could compete with some of those guys, some really good players. So I wasn't totally overwhelmed, you know, when I got to Hopkins. But yeah, they're like anything, there's a big transition from going to and being the guy in high school and the guy that could like control things and knew everything that was going on and, you know, were the big man on campus your senior year in high school and all that stuff. And then all of a sudden you're fighting and clawing to win spots and do all that stuff. My freshman year at Hopkins, I played a lot of short stick defensive middie, which I wasn't really kind of used to, but I played a lot. So I wasn't really complaining. And, you know, we had a pretty good team that year. And my sophomore year, we went to the national championship game and just start climbing up the ladder. But I worked really hard to do it. Lacrosse was really important. I spent a lot of time in the weight room, again, partly because I wasn't the biggest guy. At that time, I was probably 6'1", 175 pounds, so I knew I had to like really work hard in the weight room. And there was a guy at Hopkins, this guy Bill Starr, that really kind of took me under his wing, and I got really strong and lifted really hard, and I think that helped me even to this day, you know, staying in shape and doing that stuff. But I put a lot into it. I probably put too much into it. I probably didn't study enough, but I put a lot of time and effort into being a really good lacrosse player. I lifted a lot of weights. I played a ton of basketball and really concentrated on being a really good lacrosse player.
Do you remember the first time at Hopkins when you felt like all that work had paid off? Like when maybe you made an impact or did something that you had been working on or just played at a different level and you realized that your game had been elevated? Was there anything tangible?
To me, it was always just about helping the team and earning playing time and playing the best you can to help the team win. And I don't really remember a moment that I was like, you know, wow, this is this or this is that or this clicked. I just always wanted to be good and help our team win games and compete. It was always a thing that was, I don't know if it was like inbred in me or if it was, you know, somehow my grandfather or whatever, but I loved competing. I loved, you know, sports. I loved getting at after people and testing myself against the guy in front of you or, you know, stopping somebody or trying to, you know, even when I was little, score in basketball or, you know, running back and football, whatever it was, right? I just loved competing. And I don't know. I mean, and it's funny because when you coach, I think there's certain things that you can teach kids and there's certain things you can get kids to get better at, but some of that stuff is really hard. It's really hard to kind of put some aggression into kids. And I always had a little bit of an aggressive streak, you know, on the field. And it's also, I think, to really get kids to really compete. My coaches talk about that all the time, try to get the kids to compete at that highest level. But I think part of it is if it's not in those kids.
Yeah, there's only so much you can do.
Yeah, there's only so much you can do. I don't know. I don't know why it was, but I always liked doing it.
Favorite memories from your college days?
I mean, there's a ton. I mean, I made a ton of friends. I met my wife at Johns Hopkins. So there's a lot of off-field memories that were awesome and locker room memories. And I still am very close with, you know, my teammates from Hopkins. The on-field stuff, you know, my sophomore year, we had a really great year. The first game of the season, we beat Syracuse. And I probably had the best game that I'd had in a long time. And I covered Paul Gate and did a really good job on him, and we ended up beating Syracuse. Unfortunately, later in the year, we played them in the national championship game in the final, they ended up beating us by a goal, and it's one of the best games in college across history, and I think people see that as a highlight, and it was a great game, but the first game was better, that's for sure.
When did you start thinking you were going to be able to play pro?
Well, back then, pro was different.
It was a different world than what we have now.
You know, my freshman year in college, my wife and I, you know, it was my girlfriend at the time. She was actually busting my chops about not studying enough. And she was like, you know, what are you doing? Why don't you study more? What aren't you motivated? You know, what do you want to do? And one of the things that I wanted to do was make the U.S. team. And, you know, I was this 17, 18-year-old kid, and that was a long way out there. I was a good player as a freshman, but I wasn't like some superstar. And I looked at her and I said that, and she kind of looked at me like I was crazy. So I always wanted to do that. I'd seen those games. There were some games at Johns Hopkins, the World Games, and my family and I actually drove to Toronto and watched the World Games there. So I'd always kind of like that had been one of my goals. And, you know, seems silly for a young, scrawny college kid as a sophomore to have that goal, but it really was. And then, you know, as I kind of got to my senior year, I started to get familiar with the indoor stuff and, you know, was lucky enough to get drafted by the Wings. I was coaching at Princeton, and they kind of did a little bit of a regional draft, I think. So I think I could have got drafted by Baltimore or Philly, and was lucky enough to get, you know, picked by them. And then that started to – I didn't really know a whole lot about box lacrosse, to be quite honest with you. But, you know, I was like, I know how to play defense, and I know, you know, what basketball is, and it's very similar. And again, just figured out how to get some stuff done and competed and, you know, ended up playing with one of the best groups of guys, you know, not only talent-wise for 7 or 8 years, whatever I played for the Wings, but just all those guys are still, you know, really, really great friends. And, you know, lucky enough when I moved up here that those guys were around, and just a really great group. So that started to happen. You know, when I got out of college, club lacrosse was like the big thing. And then the pro kind of circuit started to kind of mull around later in my kind of playing days. And I played in there was a kind of a showcase, the first year of the I don't even know what it was called back then, I guess the MLL, the first pro league. We kind of just went around. It was like
barnstormed
and went to different stadiums. They were trying to figure out who could handle it and, you know, where we could get some crowds and stuff. And then, you know, that all that stuff started to click. I never thought, like some kids hopefully are thinking now, that they can maybe make a living being a pro lacrosse guy. You know, when I played for the Wings, we made $125 a game my first year, and they took taxes out of that. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, they gave you a check after you played, and it was $75 or whatever it was. And a lot of the Wings guys signed that over to the bartender that night and said, you know, let me know when I'm done. So it was definitely not pro. Even though it was, but yeah, it was more just playing at the highest level, competing against the best guys. You know, my big goal was to make the U.S. team, and I was lucky enough to do that twice.
And I want to come back to that, but for people that aren't familiar, outdoor lacrosse, and then, you know, you talk about box lacrosse, you didn't have a lot of experience prior to this. It seems like a whole different world. Yes, it is lacrosse, but skill sets, what you need to focus on, is it completely different? Because I was a terrible soccer player, but I played it growing up.
Yeah.
Outdoor, indoor,
yeah.
Completely different styles, what you need to do. How is it for box?
It's very different. I mean, obviously, some of the skills translate, you know, some of the stick skills, but even the strategies on offense are very different. The strategies on D are pretty different. The goalies are obviously, you know, different. You know, it's a stick and a ball and helmets and gloves and all that stuff. But it is a very different game, and it's very similar to the difference between indoor soccer and outdoor soccer. It's very similar to those kind of differences too. But yeah, it was great. I mean, it was a great experience. It was great learning from, you know, from some of the older Wings guys and some of the Canadian guys. And you know, I was lucky, like I said, lucky enough to get on a great team, had great leaders, and just an awesome, you know, awesome group of guys. So you know, I feel blessed to have been part of that team for 7 years, I think I was on the Wings.
How long did it take you to feel comfortable with the indoor game? I mean, obviously you knew what you were doing, but like where stuff started to become second nature like it did, I'm sure, playing outside.
You know, I was lucky. I do feel like the transition, especially for an American player that didn't grow up playing that game, it was much easier to make the transition playing defense than it was for guys to make that transition playing offense. So for me, things clicked. There was a couple of like little tricks I learned early, but you know, things click pretty quickly for me. And you know, some of the offensive guys, I do think it's a little harder to transition in that league, but D guys, it's just you know,
you're still trying to stop the other guy.
Yeah, you're still trying to stop the other guy. You don't have the big long stick. It's not you know, you're not relying on that stuff. A lot of it's physical, you know, similar to, you know, pick and roll stuff in basketball. I always grew up playing pickup basketball and basketball, so that stuff kind of came naturally. You know, I guess in basketball, you're not getting cross-checked in the back while you're getting picked, and that's the big trick in indoor, is like not letting guys get to your back when you play defense. But I learned that pretty quickly and transitioned pretty well with that stuff. You know, I was never a superstar in that league. I was a really good defenseman. I never scored. I think I had maybe 3 goals in 7 years or something. But again, I was a part of a really good team, and I was a good D guy. So I just knew my role and did it.
And there was a passionate following for Wings, the first – and there is the new iteration, but this original iteration. Like, how familiar were you with Philadelphia and everything before you got waist-deep in it as a member of the Wings?
So when I was in – I was probably 12 years old. I was playing football, and the coach brought – our football guy brought a bunch of guys from my team up to Philly to watch the Flyers play the Rangers. And we sat all the way up at the top of the spectrum. And there was a section of Rangers fans kind of right next to us, and right next to them was a section of Flyers fans. And by the end of the game – there was nobody in those two sections. They all got thrown out for fighting. So as this 12-year-old looking around, watching these like crazy hockey guys going bananas and beating each other up in the stands, that was my first introduction really to Philly, you know, fans. And, you know, the funny thing was, is I think the Wings crew, the fans were incredible that we had. They came to – we had more fans at some of our practices than some people had, you know, at their games. And they traveled and they came everywhere, and they were just great, great people. But a lot of those guys weren't familiar with lacrosse, right? They were just Wings fans. They were Philly fans, and they knew there was an opportunity. A lot of them were Flyers fans that I think couldn't get Flyers tickets or, you know, that just liked the sport because it was similar to hockey. So they weren't big lacrosse people. They were Wings fans. So, but they were a great group. Yeah.
Time for a break on One-on-One. More with Brian Volker coming up. But right now, there's nothing quite like the Honda Accord Hybrid and the CR-V Hybrid when it comes to exhilarating efficiency. With hybrid technology and thrilling capability, these vehicles deliver an electrifying performance on every drive. Discover for yourself what truly makes these hybrids special. Redefine your driving experience with Honda. KBB.com's best value brand of 2023. Contact your local Honda dealer today about the Honda Accord Hybrid and the CR-V Hybrid. And now on One-on-One with Matt Leon, let's return to our conversation with Brian Volker, who just recently retired as the head men's lacrosse coach at Drexel University.
So you talk about you're on the U.S. national team. What was the process like for making that? And this time, this is coming out of college?
I was out of college. I graduated in 91, and I made the team in 94. So the tryouts were probably in, you know, in 93, a couple years out of college. The tryouts for the U.S. team are if anybody wants to go watch lacrosse, and it's a little different. They do the process a little bit different now. And obviously with the pro league, it is a lot easier to kind of like narrow down that process a little bit. But, you know, I think in those days they took 100 and some guys and sent them invitations, and you showed up for a weekend at some college and you were in the dorms and, you got on different teams and you just played. And it was incredible. It was, you know, guys really like pinning their ears back, you know, like had something like, you know, really tangible in their sights. Guys worked really hard to do it. And there were a lot of great players. And again, I feel fortunate. There were 20, whatever, 30 guys, whatever were on that team. The next 30 were pretty close to being as good as us. There was a lot of hard fought battles. And at the end, there were always like, you could tell they were kind of narrowing stuff down, and, you know, you never really know which list you were on or weren't, and guys were really going at it. But those tryouts were incredible. Great experiences. I'm still a little bitter. I didn't make the first under-19 team. So I was just graduated from high school, and there was a tryout, and I met some really cool people that I didn't really know what Long Island was, and I met some Long Island guys, and then, you know, I met Andy Towers, you know, guy's a good buddy of mine. Him and I met in the hallways, like, you know, this crazy guy from Connecticut. And that's when I realized there was a lot of personalities in lacrosse. But I thought I played well enough to make the team, and I didn't make it. And I was like, that was always something that I was had a little chip on my shoulder, you know, when I was going through college. Like, hey, that guy was on the team, you know, I'm going to be better than him. But yeah, those tryouts are, you know, they're incredible. And again, even with that team, it's the same thing. Like, there were 10, 12, 15 guys that were good enough to make that team that didn't make it. And some of those guys ended up being better college players than others. And that's just how the process goes.
What are some of the big memories from your time with the U.S. national team? Like, what jumps out when you think of the time? Because you won a couple of gold medals with them and, you know, played a lot of games.
So in 1994, we played, we played in England, and Tony Seaman was the head coach. You know, again, a lot of it is just time hanging with the guys, getting to know each other. We did a couple of exhibition games like on weekends, and then we had a week out in Vail, Colorado. There's a big lacrosse tournament out there with some really good competition. So we went out there and played and had a lot of fun out there and played, and then, you know, flew over to Manchester, hung in the dorms that weren't so nice. But again, it was great just hanging out with guys and playing lacrosse and being in Europe. That's the first time I had ever been there. I know a lot of guys traveled after that. I did with my wife. So it was just an awesome experience. Obviously, winning is a huge part of it, but just the connections and the friendships and the teammates that are still friends today, that stuff's really important to me. And then in 1998, the games were at Hopkins, and I lived in Baltimore, and I was coaching at Hopkins at the time. So that was really cool, playing at Homewood and having big crowds in Baltimore and, you know, again, having fun after games and, you know, again, training camps. And one of the crazy memories is we took and I should know the year, but I don't know if it was the first or the second team. I guess it was the first team. We had an exhibition game up in Boston, and a bunch of guys from Baltimore rented an RV and drove to Boston. And the couple of the guys in the back had some adult beverages, and we were, you know, kind of hanging out, having fun, joking around. And we were watching the NBA finals on the little TV in the RV. And then can't really hear stuff, but we're watching, and it's a good game. And all of a sudden, like, something breaks in, and there's this like white car driving like on the road. And we're all like, you know what's going on. It was like the whole OJ Simpson thing. and we all had to pull over. We pulled the car over and put the antenna up, and we're, you know, we're watching this thing. It was like the Twilight Zone, right? It was like, you know, where were you? And I was in this RV, like driving to Boston in a, for a game with the U.S. team. But that's one of the things that pops out. It was a crazy, crazy thing. But look, back in those days, again, guys played club. There wasn't a professional thing, you know, so lacrosse has always had the reputation of being a, you know, a sport where guys like to play and go, you know, get after each other and have a lot of fun. And then, you know, after club games, everybody opened the coolers,
right,
and guys sat down and
had a lot of
fun. So it was a little bit different, you know, a little bit of a different thing. Like the USA experiences, I think, are different now. And, you know, guys are used to it being very, you know, much more professional. Those guys probably aren't having quite as much fun as we had back in the day. But again, I just, you know, I feel blessed to be a part of those teams and just like the teammates and the, you know, we won both times, and it was just an incredible experience, and just the friendships and the teammates and the hanging in the dorms and the having the fun and telling stories and, you know, and then having a couple of beers afterwards and joking around and even really joking around with the guys that you played against, like that, you know, you'd go play the Canadian team or the Iroquois or the English or whatever, and then we beat each other up, and then guys would be like hanging around with each other afterwards. So that was definitely a great experience.
And was it like the World Championships?
Yes. Is that So, and that's grown a lot. So, you know, when I played, there were the other countries, you know, there weren't a lot of other countries. I think at Johns Hopkins in 98, there started to be some, but those games didn't look like the
right
games we were playing in. And even in our league, I think there were like six or eight teams, seven or something, you know, really like the U.S. and Canada, you know, Australia in 94 was pretty good, but it was really a kind of a two or three team kind of race. And now, you know, it's still kind of a two team race, I think, between Canada and the U.S., but those other teams or the levels have really come up and are a little bit different. So that's a neat thing.
When did you decide to stop playing at a level? You know, was it a decision made for you, or did you hit a point where it's just getting harder to bounce back? It's getting harder to get the engine started at the beginning of the season.
Yeah, so I remember when I decided I should stop playing indoor is it was 1998. I was coaching at Johns Hopkins. I had my Wings equipment bag underneath the bench, and we were playing a game in Rochester the night Saturday night, and I was at Homewood Field in Baltimore coaching. And then as soon as the game was over, I literally grabbed my equipment bag, jumped in a car, went to the airport. I landed, I think, like 25 or 30 minutes before the game was supposed to start in Rochester. And thank goodness the stadium's so close and small town. And I got there and was getting my ankles taped. And, it, you know, I ended up making the opening whistle. And I just remember, like, something happened, and there was, like, a ground ball, and a guy from Rochester threw the ball over my head. And I'm like, what's he doing? And there was a guy wide open behind me. And Dallas, I think, ended up making the save, and it kind of woke me up and stuff. But I was like, wow, this is getting tougher to do. So that was my last year playing indoor in 98. And part of it was that I lived in Baltimore, and it was getting harder to kind of, like, get up there and do that commute. And then, you know, still was playing a little bit outdoor, but then when the first iteration of that, the MLL started, I had the chance to be the head coach for Baltimore. And I think there was like some talk of me playing and coaching, but I just didn't feel like that was the right way to go about it. So I was like, okay, I'm done. I'm not going to play anymore. And then after that first year, there was some stuff that went on with the ownership and, you know, some things that I felt like I better move on and do something else, and scrambled to get the job, and was lucky enough to get the job at Penn. But I thought I was done, so I ended up having to play that next year. And, you know, I was hoping that the league would put me – I was living in Baltimore. I had kids. The league was nice enough to pay me pretty well, but had me play up in Boston, and I was flying back and forth every weekend. And my wife was, like, looking around, like, you're okay, you're leaving me here with the little ones again. So that was kind of tough. And then that next year I got the job at Penn. And I was like, I'm done. I'm not going to play. My good buddy, you know, John DiTomaso, was like, I'm going to trade for you. He was the coach of Long Island. I was like, don't trade for me. I don't want to play. It's too much. It's too much with the new job and the kids. And I, you know, talked to my wife about it, and she's like, yeah, you should go play. It would be really cool if the kids, you know, see you play. So I ended up playing that last year for Long Island. It was challenging, but it was great. Great group of guys. We ended up winning the championship here at Villanova. And the cool thing was we beat Baltimore, who I – been the coach of 2 years before. And then that was kind of like, okay, I've had enough.
And it sounds like you were able to, like, it closed the book properly and we're good. And it was now great. It's coaching.
Yeah, it was coaching. So, and, you know, I still had, like, pick up basketball and you know, and some stuff. I was still, like, you know, working out a little bit and running and stuff. So I always had that kind of physical stuff to do. But, yeah, it was great to go out on the championship and finish it that way. You know, won the championship in indoor and stopped playing, and won the championship, you know, in outdoor and stopped playing. So that felt like that was good to go.
Going back in time, did you always figure you would eventually coach?
You know, I never really thought about doing much else. I never really felt like I was going to be a coach, but lacrosse was very important. Like I said, in college, it was probably too important. And then had the chance to coach at Princeton with Coach Tierney. And obviously, you know, if not the greatest, you know, college coach of all time, won the national championship that year. Was like, okay, I'm going to go do something else, move closer to Baltimore. My wife and I were real serious at the time. We weren't married yet. She was living in D.C., so I wanted to get back closer to her. Like I said, worked for a couple of years, worked for, you know, the guy that owns the Ravens, Steve Bisciotti. Worked my butt off for, you know, a couple of years with some really great people, but didn't really excite me all that much.
What were you doing?
I was a recruiter. He had this company that hired technical kind of recruit people for part-time jobs. Great company. Steve's an awesome guy. Works guys to the bone, but treats them great. And just, you know, did that for a couple of years and then worked for Boathouse Sports, which is out of here. Again, for a great, great guy, John Stropbeck, and, you know, got sports and got the whole thing. And then just, you know, again, did that for about 2 years and then had the chance to get back into college coaching and just felt like it was what I was meant to do.
For a lot of those early years as an assistant coach, still playing, how did it help you as a coach? Because I would imagine you stay connected and you kind of, there's an empathy for what guys are going through, and it's always there if you're a former player, but I think the further away you get from it, it's easy to romanticize and, and, you know, soften the edges. Right. You're still grinding and you're helping these guys. Do you feel like that was really, as a young coach, it helped you?
You know, it's funny because the one lesson I think I learned from coaching, and it was more from playing and kind of watching my coaches, was you have to be yourself. And if you're not, the kids can really see through it, right? No matter how good you are at masking things, you got to be yourself. You know, I coach for very different personalities, Coach Tierney, Coach Seaman, John Hawes, you know, those guys were very different personalities, but I also felt like, and I learned that there wasn't one way to do things, right? But the one thing that you had to do is be kind of true to your own personality and true to yourself. I do think it helped, you know, I think when I was at Hopkins, you know, the kids knew that I was pretty good and was still playing. You know, I tell the story that, I would be the guy that was warming up the goalies, and Brian Carcaterra was, you know, really good player and really good goalie. And we had a great, you know, kind of rapport and did some really good things together. But then, you know, he realized that he was going to be the goalie of the English national team and that I was going to, you know, be on the U.S. team. And I was like, I'm going to score on you. You know that, right? And I ended up doing it. I felt like I always related well to the kids. You know, that didn't mean that I couldn't, you know, yell at them or say, hey, we're not doing this right, or hey, we got to work harder. But, you know, till last August and when I retired, you know, I always felt like I was never a coach that, like, wanted to play mind games with kids, right? I wanted to tell them, hey, this is what we think. This is what we need you to do better. This is what you need to do to play, whether you were, you know, the best guy on the team or the last guy. Not try to play mind games. Try to tell kids the truth. Sometimes they didn't want to hear the truth, but, you know, tell them the truth and treat them fairly. And if you did that, then things would go well. So I guess being able to play and, you know, help with that stuff. But by the time, you know, I was a head coach, then it was like, I'm getting old. I'm not playing a lot. But, you know, I always, you know, when I was at Penn, I played a lot of pickup basketball with the guys on the team and felt like that helped me relate to those guys a little bit. But just, you know, help them say, hey, that's Coach. He's not a terrible athlete, even though he doesn't have any hair anymore and all that stuff. But, you know, I didn't do it to do that. It just kind of came naturally. But, yeah, I mean, I hope it helped me relate to those guys a little bit.
When you come to Penn, what's the window, what's the door that opens there that gets you that opportunity? And taking over a Division I program, obviously all kinds of experience, but now you're the guy in charge of a program. What was it like at first?
Well, you know, I was scrambling because I was playing in Boston. I, you know, stepped down as the coach and the kind of the general manager of the Bayhawks down in Baltimore. and you know, was scrambling, and it was like interviewing, and had this opportunity to interview at Penn. A good friend of mine was kind of the other guy. Dave Metzbauer was like the other guy, kind of in for the job, and we were talking and going back and forth. I had a couple of Division III offers. I actually had another Division I offer. Thank God they offered me so little money that I had to turn it down, and was like, you know, really kind of just scrambling to do that stuff, and was lucky enough to get that opportunity at Penn. Penn was coming off of a couple of not so great years, but it had some years, you know, back when Coach Seaman, who was my coach my senior year at Hopkins. So I had a little bit of a connection there, and I think that helped with some of the alums. But yeah, just got to Philly and just decided to, like, you know, pin my ears back and do what I could to help and coach kids. And again, had to learn a lot of things, but also, you know, had a good group of kids. And the coach that was there before me, Matt Hogan, had done a real good job of, like, recruiting, but he was only there for a year or two, I think. And, you know, we had some good kids in the pipeline and ended up having, you know, a couple of really good seasons in the 7 years that I was there. I don't think I got the support that I would, you know, I wanted or needed to be really good on a consistent basis. And I was kind of, you know, banging on the door, trying to tell people there that they could be a lot better, and didn't think that that was going to kind of move the needle there. So I ended up taking the job at Drexel, which I think surprised a lot of people, but I just felt like there was more support there. And Mike's done a great job at Penn. I think I helped him a little bit because I think they listened when I left. But Mike's a great coach, and he's done a really good job there, and they're very good. And I knew they could be good. Maybe Mike's a better coach than I am, but he's done a really good job. So it was a great opportunity for both of us.
You mentioned having to learn a lot when you first dig over, like, what was the biggest thing you had to learn as a head coach?
I think it's like the off the field stuff, right? It's all the responsibilities. It's the, you know, just the kind of the paperwork and the administrative side of it. When you're an assistant, you deal, you know, you're dealing a lot with obviously recruiting and some of that stuff and the on field kind of hands on. But when you're the head coach, it's like, okay, I can't just be focusing on the D guys and, you know, be the D coordinator and, like, know a lot of the offensive guys, but not, you know, deal with them. You had to, like, you know, be the whole team's coach. But it's more the stuff off the field and the administrative stuff. And that, you know, at Penn, it was figuring out. I felt like I was a math student a lot because I was figuring out SAT scores and class rank numbers and who I could get in and who I couldn't. So there was a big learning curve there with that stuff. But yeah, I think just the administrative part of it and honestly some of the fundraising part of it. When you're assistant coach, you don't worry about the fundraising stuff. When you're a head coach, it becomes really important. It was really important at Penn. I felt like, you know, it was three quarters of my job sometimes was fundraising.
When you take over, you have success at Penn, you talk about coming to Drexel. How much more prepared did you feel at Drexel with the experience of Penn? I mean, it had to be, I would imagine, kind of a different world as far as feeling more comfortable hitting the ground running.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, once you're even at Penn, once you're there for, you know, a couple, 2 years, 3 years, you really start to get the swing of things, the hang of things, how things work. You know, who to go to get this thing fixed, who to stay away from, you know, when to keep your head down, when to pop it up. I think anywhere, you know, when you have a new job, when you figure those things out, things are good. But yeah, being a first-time head coach, figuring out kind of the ropes and a lot of those other responsibilities, then when you get that second job, you know, you still have to figure out, you know, who to go to, mm-hmm. to get your parking space and, like, all those, right. You know, all those, like, things that are unique to each school. But the other part of it, like the learning curve of being a head coach, you know, changes. I say it all the time. Yeah, the kids were, you know, the kids were different a little bit, but the kids were the same too. There were a lot of similarities. But, you know, look, at Drexel, you know, every team was a little bit of a different personality, just like it was at Penn. So I never felt like it was like, oh, I'm going from an Ivy League to the, you know, I just wanted to coach the kids and be successful and make sure those kids had a really good experience.
At Drexel, when do you feel like, how many years do you feel like it took for you to really hit your stride? I don't even mean necessarily wins and losses, but, like, it really started to become your program and you knew you had the vision and you could start to see the vision come together.
Yeah, I mean, you know, those first couple of years, again, Chris Bates, a good friend of mine, wings guy, you know, he did a really good job at Drexel. When he left to go to Princeton, that's when I got the head coaching job. Mike took the job at Penn. It's funny, we had all run a tournament together called King of the Hill. And, you know, we called it kind of the King of the Hill shuffle. you know, one guy went, you know, we all filled each other spots. But, yeah, for the first – for the and Batesy, Chris had been there as an assistant coach and as a head coach for, I think, maybe 15 years also together. So he had really put his stamp on the program and done some really good things and changed what Drexel, you know, kind of their trajectory, to be quite honest, and, you know, got a locker room built and did some really, really good things. So again, I was lucky to kind of step into a program that I felt like was on the rise. You know, Nick Gannon was the associate athletic director. He's a lacrosse guy, had that support. Dr. Zilmer was there, wanted, you know, felt like he wanted to be good. So it was just all felt like walked into a good spot. Now it was a tough place to recruit and it's an expensive school and like some of that stuff. So for the first 3 or 4 years, you know, especially even the first year, you tippy toe around a little bit. You don't want to make, at least I was never a guy that wanted to like, totally, you know, reverse 180. I'm like, hey, this is how we're going to do it. But like, I know this is how things went last year. So try to, you know, kind of tippy toe around that a little bit because I thought we could be good. I think as you're at a place, you start coaching kids, you know, obviously after the, like maybe the third or fourth year, like you feel like you have your own alumni base a little bit and guys know you're there and you're there for the right reasons. I think that's when anybody in a program starts to make it really feel like, okay, this is me. This is, you know, I'm putting my personality on it. It's, you know, my kids that I've recruited, not only that are here all in the program, but also that are like graduated and now can support us and come to the games. And, you know, they know the coach now. It's not some guy that, that just showed up, you know, a couple of years ago and I don't know those guys, but I had a great experience at Drexel. Great kids, the alums, you know, that played for me, that didn't play for me, super supportive, great, great people, just a, you know, really good place. Not the easiest place in the world, you know, for a good amount of reasons, but also just also a good place and great kids.
Favorite memories there? I mean, you had a lot of success, won a couple of conference championships. What are the memories?
Yeah, I mean, I a little selfishly, but, you know, those teams that won the, you know, in 2014 and 2021, you know, it was the first time Drexel had won the CAA and gone to the NCAA tournament was in 2014. You know, again, a little bit crazy fate, but ends up playing Penn at Franklin Field in the first round of the NCAA tournament in 2014. And we were losing the game, and at, right before half, our faceoff guy, you know, wins a couple of faceoffs right in a row, pushes the ball forward and scores, and you know, gets the game back. And I was like, yeah, great coaching, right? The guy, you know, just makes three great plays or whatever, and we're back in the game. And I think Penn kind of like was like, oh my god, now what do we do? And we end up winning that game. So that was pretty cool. Obviously, it was cool to go back there and win at Franklin Field. But yeah, I mean, those are it. You know, just want to like really. Those two things, you know, winning the conference in 21 was awesome, but also, you know, a lot of great kids, a lot of great memories, a lot of great, like hanging out with guys in the locker room and in my office and joking around and just a lot of great relationships. So
when people think about your time as Drexel head coach, what do you hope they take away?
Yeah, like that we always competed, that we always had an opportunity to win the CAA championship. Again, I'm really proud that we, you know, I was there 15 years and we missed the CAA tournament twice. Just teams that always competed and that league's always really good. There's a lot of schools that lacrosse is really important and they have good coaches and good facilities and all that stuff. And we were able to compete with those guys, you know, on a year-to-year basis. Felt like I brought in really good kids that represented the, you know, the team really well. And like I said, for me, I hope that the kids there had just a really good experience. And so we didn't always win, but I felt like we did it kind of the right way.
You played at such a high level and had success. I'm curious, and I ask this of a lot of coaches who have the trail you do. Does success hit differently as a player than it does as a coach?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, again, as a player, you know, in some ways you feel like you control more of it. You know, you don't necessarily, but you feel like that. You know, again, sometimes as a coach – you know, you come up with all these game plans and you do this and you do that. And then all of a sudden it's like, wait, what did we not just talk about that? But look, coaching is very rewarding. And again, as somebody that loves sports, you know, it was great to be out on the field kind of on that, you know, day-to-day basis, teaching kids things about lacrosse and about life a little bit, you know, hanging out with those guys, game planning to beat, you know, Towson, Delaware, Hofstra, whatever it was, you know, to win big games, to, you know, go through that stuff. But yeah, it is different. And again, what you have to do is kind of separate yourself as a player and the things that maybe even you did well or took for granted and really be able to break things down for kids and say, you know, we have to do this and here's the steps to get there. You have to be able to do that stuff.
And my final question, are you absolutely, completely convinced that you're done coaching?
I think so. I don't people have asked me about high school, going back and coaching at high school. I don't know if I could deal with the parents, to be quite honest. I said maybe if I was like the, you know, the volunteer that nobody knew and I could just come up, you know, show up and coach the kids and the parents that barely knew my name and maybe it was just someplace a little warmer than here, I would think about that. I don't think I would do the college thing again. It's a very all-encompassing job, and in a lot of ways, that's what makes it great, but it also limits what you're, you know, you can do. It's going to be great to be able to go on a weekend in February and go do something when I could never do that stuff. And I was always a guy that when I had the opportunity, my friends joke, I love to go to the Caribbean, sit on a beach and read a book and just relax a little bit. And I took plenty of opportunities to do that stuff, but I had, you know, very limited times that I could do it. So I doubt I would do that again. You know, if I could maybe help with the U.S. team or help with an indoor team or help with a pro team or, you know, some of that stuff, I might do it. I don't think I'm going to do any of that this year. I think I want to take a deep breath this year and just kind of figure out what I will or won't do. Part of it is I do have to figure out some hobbies. I'm not a golfer. I'm not like a tennis player. I didn't have a lot of those hobbies. So I have to figure out what I'm going to do with some free time. But my wife and I are doing some yoga. We're trying to be healthy. We're trying to, like, you know, do some of that stuff and just enjoy life. And yeah, I kind of look at it and getting older and life's too short sometimes. So just want to be able to take advantage of things.
Brian Volker, thanks so much for coming in. This was great.
You got it. Thanks for having me.
And that will do it for this episode of One on One with Matt Leon, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. Want to thank former Drexel head men's lacrosse coach Brian Volker for being our guest this week. Now, if you like the show, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor, leave us a rating and a review. You can follow the show on X at One on One Pod. You can follow me there as well at MattLeon1060. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to check us out again next week when we bring you another conversation with someone you should know more about.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.